Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. It was great to see so many of you last week at our KMJ Lifestyle Expo, and good to know that so many of you are listening to this show and, like me, learning a lot from the guests on this program. I think that'll be the case today as we visit with a 91-year-old World War II veteran who was somewhere very interesting on June 6th, 1944. And I think you probably know what that date means. We'll explore that, but let's talk about another date before that. R. Philip Benson of Madera, California, my guest today. And Mr. Benson, I like to ask every veteran this, you know this, December 7th, 1941, where were you and how did you hear about the attacks on Pearl Harbor?
Already in the military, coming out of church, and we heard news that the Pearl Harbor was bombed.
And since you were already in the military, I guess maybe you were a little more prepared for an announcement like that than maybe somebody who had no clue.
Perhaps, yes.
How long had you been in? When did you go in the service?
I was drafted April 14, 1941.
So you'd been in for a little more than 6 months?
Yes, that's right.
Being with other troops, being with other guys in uniform, and knowing that a day like this was going to come eventually, what was the atmosphere like in the wake of that news? Were people shaken? Were they stirred? Were they motivated? How would you describe it?
It was somber, I think. That's about the best way I could describe it.
So you're there in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And
on a weekend pass. I wasn't at my base.
Where was your base?
Camp Shelby, Mississippi.
Uh-huh.
And when I got there, everyone had gone. It was just an empty campground. I guess the Army put into effect Code 7 or whatever, some number, I don't know. And they went out guarding bridges and that sort of thing. But I stayed behind as the cadre. And it wasn't many days later they came back, all the troops did.
This all sounds a little unnerving, though. You go to Baton Rouge on a weekend pass, and kind of the fun is sucked out of that when you hear this announcement. Then you come back, and nobody's anywhere to be found.
No one. It was a little eerie.
Not Erie, Indiana. You're from Gary, Indiana.
Gary, Indiana, right.
So there you are at Camp Shelby. And how long was it from this time till when you actually ended up going overseas? Was it a while yet?
Oh, let's see. I went overseas first to the Hawaiian Islands for 9 months. That was in June of 42, I think. Yes, and came back about March of 43.
Because you wouldn't be headed to the Pacific. You would be headed to the European continent and be part of the initial landing at Normandy on June 6th of 44. But a lot happened between what we're talking about and then. And I'm curious, when you were drafted, when you went into the Army, did you have an idea of what you wanted to do? And how long was it before the Army gave you an idea of what the Army wanted you to do?
I had no idea what I wanted to do, and I don't think the Army did either.
I like that answer. So how was it that you ended up in the 6th Engineers Special Brigade?
Oh, that's a long story.
Well, we've got some time on this program.
I was in the Hawaiian Islands, and I decided, instead of being a private first class, I wanted to move up, so I applied for officers' candidate school and got accepted to the quartermaster school in Camp Lee, Virginia. So they picked me and sent me there, and I spent 3 months, and I came out a 90-day wonder, as they call them.
Because normally the process of becoming an officer would take you quite a bit longer than 90 days.
Oh, yes.
So that was good for you. It made the paycheck a little bigger.
Yes. Well, a few quarters, not much more, I guess. I don't recall what it was.
So then what? How did they make an engineer out of you?
Oh, I was in the quartermaster corps then, and they shunted me all around the states, going here and there. And then I was put on a ship. The Queen Mary, it was, left from New Jersey and went to Greenock, Scotland. It was a four or five days, very fast. And then they put you down in a replacement depot. You know, the Army has supply depots for hammers and nails and shoes and supplies of food. They also have for people. It's called a REPL depot, meaning replacement depot. Mm-hmm. And I was in there. And I guess they needed some bodies there, so I was picked and put in there. And I moved to Torquay, England. It was a beautiful place.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of their Miami of England.
So you're in Europe, and you know that the Americans are going to be crossing the channel eventually.
Uh-huh.
When did you get a sense that this is all pretty imminent and that the momentum was starting to build? I imagine there was some training that you had to participate in.
Oh, yes. We made one practice invasion where we left and took off like we were going to on the invasion. And we had to get rid of all of our bedding. We were living in rented apartments. We had to turn in everything. And we took off, and then all the ships turned to the right and went into Slapton Sands, maybe.
Well, Slapton Sands was the site of a notorious tragedy in World War II that we didn't fully learn about till years later. But
yes.
But you were there for that. It was Exercise Tiger. But did you have any clue at the time that American forces in what was supposed to be a training accident, a training exercise, were actually being killed?
No, I didn't. We heard nothing of it.
What kind of role did you have in an invasion type exercise like that?
Well, just a regular. I didn't have any special role. I had I was a second lieutenant, and I had 100 people under me. And when we go ashore, we have to have say 20 on one boat, mm-hmm. 10 on another, and 30. In case one is sunk, you don't lose the whole outfit. So we landed there in England as a practice invasion.
Right.
And then we went back to where we were in Torquay, England, and got our bedding back. No, I lived in a home. I didn't have to get rid of my bedding, but the others did, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And we stayed there for another month or so, and then we were called to go again. And this time, I guess we thought it was the real thing, because we went to a different port. We went to Portland Hard, the southern part of England.
Mm-hmm.
And then on June 4th, we left to make the invasion, and the seas were so rough, Eisenhower, our chief commander, called us all back. So we waited till the 5th of June. I should have said June there.
That's right. You said June, yeah.
Yeah, right. So we left on the 5th of June, and I never saw so many ships in my life. It was just left to right, forward and backward, just ships all over. Small craft, not huge things. And they all moved in and converged upon a place called Omaha and Utah,
were right.
Two landing sites.
And yeah. So that is all unfolding June 6, 1944, which we're going to talk quite a bit about. And you hit on something that I think a lot of people don't realize, or maybe were never aware of, that, and we all know June 6th is D-Day, but it would have been June 5th had you left as scheduled.
Yes, it would have, but there was a terrible storm, and Eisenhower had to call it off. So we left the day later.
And as a result, June 6th is the day that we always remember. But going back to a couple months before that, and for our listeners, just for their education, and as you said, you didn't know about this at the time, but it was late April of 1944, from the 22nd through the 30th, that these exercises were taking place on the beach at Slapton Sands.
Mm-hmm.
And German E-boats showed up and ended up killing quite a few Americans. Do you think that if that had become more known then, if you and other troops had been made aware of it, if the American people, for example, had been made aware of it, that would have done some damage or hurt the momentum that you were trying to achieve?
Could have. I hadn't thought of it. But when you're, I was 25, and everything was for adventure and so on. And I didn't see tragedy. I just saw opportunity to do something. And they told us ahead of time, when you land, there'll be many dead bodies on the beach. And I just couldn't believe that. But they were there.
And now you're talking about June 6th when you landed.
Yes.
So as an engineer group, as the 6th Engineer Special Brigade, what was the task that your outfit was charged with on June 6, 1944? Because you headed to Omaha Beach, and when people hear Omaha Beach, June 6, 1944, they think of the first wave of troops and guys getting gunned down and just the carnage everywhere.
Yes.
But what was your experience, and what were you guys doing?
Well, the original landing was around 6 in the morning, and we didn't land till around 3 at the left flank of Omaha Beach. And there wasn't that much activity there. There was some. There were, you know, bodies all over the beach and so on. But by the time we landed, there was wasn't much firing. There was some, and we went up the hill there to a flat place. And first, we had to wait a while because the people up there were still clearing out Germans. And when we got up there, then we had a space, an open yard type of thing, and we dug foxholes and got in there and spent the night.
Well,
and there was a bit of fear then, because we heard that there were many German Panzer tanks in the back there ready to move forward.
Well, you say that as if there were never fear involved in the rest of it. And I think any of us trying to walk a mile or even a few footsteps in your shoes on June 6th, 44 at Omaha Beach would have experienced quite a bit of fear. So I want to ask you more about that. First, we need to take our first break. This is Hometown Heroes. Phil Benson of Madera, our guest today. We'll hear more of his story from June 6th, 1944 through the rest of the war. You'll be surprised at how long he spent at Omaha Beach. We'll be back with the rest of the program. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
You are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
That was General Dwight Eisenhower addressing American forces just before the invasion of Normandy, which, of course, you know, occurred June 6th of 1944. And the gentleman sitting next to me today was there on June 6th, 1944. How many people can say that this many years later, nearly 66, well, more than 66 years later now, that they were actually there, and in particular at Omaha Beach on June 6th, 1944? Philip Benson of Madera, California, can tell that story, and his story is a little different. He was an engineer, part of the 6th Engineer Special Brigade. You talked about, Mr. Benson, how you were arriving later in the day, about 3 o'clock, when the first forces had hit at 6 a.m., and you weren't necessarily right in the middle of the action. You were along the left flank. There were still bullets flying, though, and the one thing that you encountered that, to me, would seem to be a little jarring, dead bodies everywhere. You said that they prepared you to see that.
Yes, they did.
But when you actually saw that carnage right in front of your face, where you could smell it, you can feel it, you can see it, how did you deal with that? What was that like?
Oh, I don't recall that. I'm sure I don't remember. It's been too long ago.
Was it just a case of having to deal with it and having no choice, so not worrying too much about it?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, you just walk over them, that's all.
And I'm sure that wasn't the only day that you saw a dead body next to you. When you see one of your fellow soldiers who has clearly paid that ultimate price, do you ever imagine yourself in his shoes?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do.
Say, that could have been me.
Yeah, right.
And you, like so many veterans, if that had been you, then there are children and grandchildren that never would have been born
right.
If you hadn't made it back.
Right.
Well, so that was June 6th. You say you dug foxholes, spent the night there. Did you get any sleep that night?
Probably, but I don't recall.
It just seemed, as someone who had never been in combat before, and you guys had had plenty of exercises, even the tragic situation at Slapton Sands, but it seems like there's nothing that can really prepare you for what you eventually had to deal with.
Right. Well, they do their best to prepare you, but the situations arise no one had ever thought of.
I know that you weren't standing near Eisenhower or there in person to hear what we just heard. But when you hear something like that, that you know was actually said by the guy in charge at the time, the guy making the decisions, the guy who's counting on you to carry out your job so the plan as a whole can succeed, does that kind of take you back to what it felt like in 1944?
Of course, I didn't hear that.
You've heard it since?
Since, yeah, maybe months, a year later or so, because we weren't in on hearing that.
Did it mean anything to you once you finally did hear it?
No, I don't recall. Yeah.
What kinds of things? So you get there June 6th, you spend the night, you're there June 7th, you end up being there for months at Omaha Beach.
Yes.
And tell our listeners what kinds of things you were doing, what job your engineer brigade had.
Well, we were our responsibility was to get the troops off the beach when they land on their LCTs and LCVPs, they lower the gate down and they go ashore. And then they have nowhere to go. So we escorted them up a hill, and we had a huge area, a place that we had picked out when we were in England. We said this would be the place where we'd use.
Mm-hmm.
And we had water. They had to pitch their own tents or live out in the open. And we just brought them up there, and they are assembled as a unit. And then the captain or whoever's in charge then takes them and goes where he's supposed to go. But we were doing that, escorting them off the beach. And then we were also bringing in supplies. The Army had what they call a duck, D-U-K-W, whatever, that meant something. Those initials meant something that way. And it was an amphibious truck. And our troops, my troops, would take the duck and go out to a ship. And they'd unload cargo and bring it in. And that was our job, to do that.
And these are the same ducks that, say, if someone goes to visit Boston, there are a lot of these ducks going around town, still from the same area, from the same era, I mean, from World War II,
yes,
that are still functioning. They use them for tour vehicles.
Uh-huh.
So obviously they're built pretty well to still be used today.
Uh-huh.
Were they difficult to maneuver, those ducks? Personally, I've never tried to drive one or float one in the water.
Oh, they work quite well, I think. I didn't ever drive one.
That just your crews were doing that?
Yes.
So you were a second lieutenant, so you,
yes,
you had rank over the guys who had to do that dirty work.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't have minded it. But I never even asked to try. I could have.
Mm-hmm. So how did you spend your days and nights?
Making sure the tents were in order and that sort of thing. Just be a guy in charge.
So is it fair to say that you ran the beach at Omaha Beach?
Oh, no, well, I can't say that, no.
You were part of the outfit that ran the beach.
I supervised the troops that that drove those trucks.
Right.
But there are other people running the beach. There were engineers.
It sounds like, though, that there's a fair amount of responsibility that rested with you and the guys with you to make sure that things were working according to plan. And I imagine on June 6th that you described earlier seeing so many ships in the water. When did it hit you, the magnitude of what this operation was and what you were a part of on June 6th and obviously what transpired from there?
Well, nothing hit me instantaneous except when we first started to leave England, I saw so many ships. And that was I was awestruck seeing so many. That was the big, then when we went across, there were ships all over the place. That was something.
Now, you mentioned earlier that first night when you dug your foxhole and settled in and tried to catch some shut-eye, that maybe there was a little fear involved at that point. How often was fear a factor for you? Was it something that you couldn't avoid? Is it true that someone who says he was never afraid is lying, or what was your experience?
Oh, no, I was afraid for a few nights. And then when our troops move inland, you get less afraid. And then there was this Felice Gap. I don't know if you ever heard of that, where the Americans just captured 80,000 Germans in there, somewhere in that area. And they could have slaughtered them all because they were all hemmed in. But they made prisoners of war out of them. But I wasn't in on that. That was not far away, though.
And your experience would end up being involved with German prisoners of war by the time you were done. But just give us a sense, if you can, of how long you stayed at Omaha Beach. And when you land somewhere, when you come all the way from the States to England, you go across the channel, you land on this momentous day, I imagine there's part of you that wants to keep going. You don't want to stop right there and stay at Omaha Beach. Was it hard for you to be there for months?
No, because I knew that was my assignment.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked at it that way. I didn't think about going in. The assignment was to stay there. So I stayed there our troops did, 2 or 3 months. I don't remember anymore.
So it was a while. And obviously the guys that were moving on couldn't be doing what they were doing if you guys weren't doing what you were doing at the beach. So
yeah.
You're unloading troops, you're getting them and supplies from the ships to shore using those ducks. And at which point, and what do you remember about when you finally were asked to move on from Omaha Beach?
Oh, let's see. We left Omaha Beach and, we stayed there. But then I had an assignment as a labor officer then. I had quite a few Germans, and they were used in a quarry to break up rock.
So these were German prisoners of war, had been captured by Americans.
Yeah, and the Germans objected to it because they said we were helping in the war effort that they were. And I said, no, we need these for roads and for that sort of thing. But they didn't have to explain anything to them. But they were concerned. They wanted to get out of the job, see.
But it was your responsibility to keep track of about 1,000 German prisoners of war?
Yes.
Did that make you nervous at all?
No.
And
They were fenced in. There was barbed wire and so on.
I've heard a lot of stories from a lot of prisoners of war in both theaters, and some of them, more so in the Pacific than in Europe, have stories of real brutality, American prisoners of war, and how they were treated. How important was it for you to treat those prisoners with respect or treat them humanely?
Well, we did that all the time. When they needed food, we had say two trucks would go down to the foods depot, and our guards would go with them, and some of the Germans from the camp would get on the truck and go down, and they would load the truck and bring it back. And they'd always steal a few things, and they'd have some goodies. And I'd go into the kitchen there, and there they're making goodies. And they'd offer me some. They had to. fancy cakes and so on.
So you would eat the baked goods from the German POWs?
Yes.
I imagine there are a few things that just pop into my mind that you might have to deal with. Obviously, the potential for one of them to escape, and you don't want them to escape on your watch.
Yeah.
You had 1,000 POWs in your care. How many ever escaped?
There were two.
How far did they get?
Well, they got on the road that goes from where we were. We were in St. Laurent-sur-Mer, and they took the road that went toward Bayeux and Cannes. And all Americans knew you were not supposed to go in there because that was off limits to Americans.
It was all British held?
It was all British held, yes. Uh-huh. And these two escaped prisoners of war who happened to get a hold of some Army shirts without POW on it, went in there like they were Americans. Well, they were nabbed immediately.
They didn't understand the problem.
They didn't understand that.
So the
British... they were back, And they were put in another prisoner of war camp. There were several around where we were. Three, I think there were.
The other thing that, obviously, the escape factor is one that's always in the back of your mind. And the other thing that occurs to me is that it's not just you. You're not the only one in charge of 1,000 prisoners
yes.
of war. Were you ever concerned that some of the men serving under you might mistreat those prisoners and then you would have to answer for it?
No, I hadn't thought of that at all.
You had that much trust in all of them?
Yep.
Did that help you see the war in a different light, to be around people who obviously in their own personal circumstances had lost their own little portion of the war and were in a helpless situation as a prisoner? Did that give you a little more human perspective on what was going on?
Oh, I can't say. I don't recall. I'd have to conjure up some idea that I'm not sure of to answer that.
Nothing stands out in your mind that having a profound impact on
yes,
you.
Yes, not at all, yeah.
Well, we're at another point where we need to catch a commercial, so we'll take a pause there with Philip Benson of Madera, come back with what he did for the rest of the war and why it's important to remember it here today. Philip Benson of Madera, who was there June 6, 1944 at Omaha Beach. Our guest today, it's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
In this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith.
I'm sure you recognize that voice, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He made that address, that's a prayer. He led the nation in prayer over the radio
yeah.
on June 6th, 1944. You were somewhere where I don't think you could hear that. I don't think you could hear FDR that day because you were a little busy with
right,
something.
Right, I could not.
But that's what the folks back home in America heard, as you and so many Americans, a sea of ships, planes, gliders, troops on the ground made that invasion at Normandy on June 6, 1944. We've been hearing about Philip Benson's experience there on June 6th and beyond. He stayed at Omaha Beach for months with the 6th Engineers Special Brigade, making sure that troops and supplies were carried ashore. He saw the occasional bullet, saw plenty of dead bodies, but survived everything just fine himself. If you had to look back at your entire time in World War II, and we'll talk about what you did the rest of the war, but is there one circumstance that you can look back on and say, that was the closest I came, that was the closest call for me, the day that I came the closest to not coming home?
I had bullets fly at me, and I don't know how far they were from me. They could have been an inch or a foot, I don't know. So
close enough to get your attention.
Yes, that's exactly right, yeah.
Is it safe to say that when you think back to what you saw firsthand at Omaha Beach, and knowing that throughout the war, everything that was going on, that 400,000 Americans did not come home from the war, you consider yourself pretty fortunate?
Oh, absolutely. Thank the Lord for it.
Amen to that.
Yeah.
Well, we heard about some of the things you did, including being in charge of 1,000 German prisoners of war that you had working in a rock quarry. But, of course, anyone who knows what was happening in Europe from June of 44 through the end of the war knows that right in the middle of that was a huge battle called the Battle of the Bulge. Mm-hmm. And that ended up impacting just about everybody in Europe, whether they were involved directly or not. And that impacted your group because they needed infantry, right? What started to happen to the men in your brigade?
The Battle of the Bulge was around Christmas time.
It sure was.
And the 106th Division was almost annihilated. And what was left of it was sent back to Brittany, France, near Normandy, and they were going to reconstitute it.
Mm-hmm.
And since I had gone to infantry school so I could be converted from a quartermaster officer to an infantry officer, and I spent 3 months in Fontainebleau, France, where the American Army had sent the infantry school there to train us. And we came back, and they put us there in Brittany to reconstitute this 106th Division.
And we've had veterans on this program who are part of the 106th, some of them who were part of those mass surrenders to the Germans, and these gentlemen became POWs. Uh-huh. But you, so a lot of the engineers serving with you had been forced to go into the infantry, but because of your rank, you weren't forced to, but you actually volunteered. You said, hey, I want to go do what they're doing.
Yes, yes.
And they told you what? Hold your horses?
No, they said you can't. You have to become an infantry officer. And that takes 3 months of training.
So if you have been a private, they would have said, sure, go ahead.
Yes.
But because you were a second lieutenant, they said.
So I said, okay, I'll do that.
Mm-hmm. So there you are in Brittany, and 1945 is getting deeper and deeper into the year, and along rolls around May. Did you have an idea that the war was about to end?
Not at all. But we were there in Brittany, in the woods, practicing, maneuvering the infantry in attack, the infantry in retreat, and all that sort of thing, and how to field strip a gun, your weapon, and that goes on and on, day in and day out. And then we were called in, and that was such a strange thing. I never heard such a thing. But rumors start spreading, the war is over. And I said, where in the world did that come from? As soon as we got on the street, there were just thousands of French women with loaves of bread, La Guerre Finie. And that was.
The war is over.
Yeah. And that was an emotional thing for me.
Did any of those French women plant a kiss on you?
Not me. We were marching down the street.
That, with everything.
I wouldn't have refused one.
Sure. You wouldn't have refused a loaf of bread, probably, either. So you spent all that time training. You had volunteered to go with your fellow engineers. Was it a little disappointing to you that you didn't get to get in on that action, or were you just thankful to be in one
Not
piece?
Not necessarily, no. And my men were just regular troops. They weren't necessarily engineers.
Right.
They were just drafted soldiers, you see.
You weren't restricted to engineers in the 6th Engineer Special Brigade. You had guys that could do just about anything.
Everything, yes.
And so there it comes, VE Day on May 8th of 1945. You march through the streets. The French people are celebrating. What did that feel like for you? Did you think the war was over for you, or did you wonder, I might still have something to do?
Oh, I thought it was over, but I didn't think that I'd be going home the next day. They took us and sent us to, I think it was Brest, France, mm-hmm. where the Germans still had submarine pens, and they never gave up, and they were still there. So we formed the perimeter around the Germans, and we were facing out to keep the French from going back in. So we did that for a week or whatever. And then we left, and they sent us to Germany.
Did you finally flush the Germans out of those submarine pens?
Oh, no, they came out on their own. They surrendered. They came out by the truckload.
That must have been a sight to see, too.
Yeah, I saw a lot of them.
I guess that kind of does underscore the fact of that your side won the war, huh?
Oh, right, that's right.
In all of these circumstances, and you were there from D-Day, literally on Omaha Beach on D-Day through VE Day in one part of the European continent or another, in all of those experiences and the things that you saw, are there some images that you can still see in your mind's eye today that kind of epitomize what that war was about and what was accomplished?
Well, there's one thing that stands out. That is when we were making the invasion, the Germans were lobbing shells on these ships.
Of course.
And there was one that landed on a Rhino ferry. A Rhino ferry was a raft.
Right.
Huge thing. And they put trucks on it and people, and it was being towed in. And a shell landed on it, and we were away from it. But next thing I know, I saw trucks way up in the air. Then as I looked longer, there were bodies higher up than that. And that really has stood in my mind for years.
I could see why. I guess that kind of tells you how small you are in the grand scheme of things.
Right. Uh-huh.
I once had a sailor tell me, he's here in the Fresno area, a Valley veteran of World War II who was in the Pacific on a big ship. And he said he used to describe their ship as a flea on an elephant. And I suppose when you see something like that, trucks and tanks and people flying up in the air,
yes,
you feel like a flea on an elephant.
Right, exactly.
So you were there in France for VE Day, saw all the celebration. But a lot of the troops that were in Europe had a feeling that they might be headed to the other part of the war that was still going on. What about you? Did you ever get the inclination that you might be headed to the...
Oh, yes. They shipped us to Germany,
mm-hmm,
and we continued to do maneuvers, practice, the infantry platoon in attack, the infantry platoon in retreat, and so on, back and forth. And how to strip the your weapon, how to put it together, and just on and on. And while we were doing that, we were told we're getting ready for the invasion of Japan.
So you had made the landings at Omaha Beach, and you're thinking you're going to have to make another landing,
yes,
on mainland Japan.
Yes, right, yes. Then they dropped the atom bomb. And I hear so many people nowadays who whimper and cry that we were so cruel to do that. And we all cheered when that happened. Thought it was a wonderful thing. It happened, helped to shorten the war.
Saved a lot of lives.
Saved many lives.
Maybe yours was one of them.
Could have been, yes.
So where were you when you got word that...
Oh, I was there in Germany, some town along the Rhine River. I don't remember the name of the town.
So I talked to a lot of veterans in the Pacific and hear how they celebrated when they heard that Japan was surrendering. Sounds like it was a pretty big deal in Germany, too. Was there a big celebration there that night?
I don't remember a celebration, but I wasn't with the civilians. I was out in the woods with the military, and we didn't have that sort of thing. But one time, when the war ended, the Americans confiscated thousands of bottles of wine. And they handed out wine to every person, a couple of bottles apiece or something. I don't know what it was.
What'd you do with it?
I brought it home and gave it to my French neighbor. He enjoyed that sort of thing.
I'm surprised it made it all the way home, that no one confiscated it along the
way.
Oh,
no.
Was there anything else you brought home with you that meant something to you?
I brought home a helmet, a German helmet, because... where I worked, the boss said, "So long, Phil, bring me home a German helmet." And I remember that. No, maybe I mailed it home to him. I don't remember. But
you got it home.
I got it home to him, yes.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Well, there are plenty of memories after more than 60 years. Philip Benson of Madera, our guest, and we're not done with him yet. We're going to take our final break, come back with hear what else he remembers about his time in the military and World War II and why it's important to talk about those things today. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We'll come down the home stretch with Philip Benson of Madera, California. He's 91 years old. He'll be 92 in January, and he is definitely young at heart. He's got about as much energy as you could ask for from someone who's 91 years old, and we've enjoyed hearing some of his memories from World War II as well. He served with the 6th Engineer Special Brigade. You heard him talk about how he had ended up in infantry training, was going to be an infantry officer, but then the war came to an end. You heard him talk about celebrating that. What you haven't heard yet was what it was like, and I like to ask so many veterans this because they usually have pretty powerful memories, but what it was like after his time overseas was over. I imagine it probably felt like a long journey from Europe back to New York Harbor and sailing past the Statue of Liberty. Is that something that made you emotional, that sticks out in your mind, or was it no big deal?
Yes, it was emotional.
Describe it for us if you can.
Oh, it was. First, we left Marseille, France, and in the Mediterranean, it was smooth sailing. But as soon as you went through the Straits of Gibraltar, it got very choppy, and you get a little seasick, and then it leveled off. And
at least you don't have to worry about the U-boats anymore, right?
No, that's right. And we were anxious to get home. And then, of course, it was emotional. And we came by the Statue of Liberty. And but it was emotional, but I can't give you any detail of it. And then we pulled up the Hudson River and docked on the Jersey Shore. And it was 2 a.m, and the first thing they did was they marched us into a cafeteria where we got a steak dinner.
Huh.
We all had steak and all the trimmings. That was enjoyable.
To the victor go the spoils.
And then I got a chance to call my mother, and she wants to know, when are you going to be home? And I had no idea. So I said, I'll be home Thursday. And that was Monday, see. And sure enough, I got home Thursday.
Had to take a train to Gary, Indiana?
I took trains, yes. I got discharged at Camp Atterbury, Indiana. And then when I called her from there, she says, what time will you be home? I said, oh, between 8 and 9. And I got home at 8:30.
You had a pretty good sense of those things.
And I hitchhiked part of the way. But it was really an enjoyable thing to come home. And my uncle and aunt was there, and my parents and my siblings.
Can you still remember the expression on her face when she
my
saw
mother?
You?
Uh-huh. No, I can't remember that, no.
You remember a pretty big hug, probably.
Oh, yes, certainly.
And I'm sure it made it clear to you how hard it must have been for them to have you gone and to not know if you'd be coming back.
Right. And my mother was from Sweden. And she didn't speak much English. It was very broken. My dad did better. He was a carpenter, and he was out in the worker world, and he spoke English quite well.
Mm-hmm.
But my poor mother, she it was Swedish for her.
Well, I'm sure that she didn't need to say a word when she saw you, because you got the message loud and clear.
Right.
So you went back to work in the steel mills there, which Gary, Indiana is famous for.
U.S. Steel.
U.S. Steel. And you married a girl that you had known before the war. You actually made it home. You had 4 kids. How many grandkids you got now?
I have 6 grandkids and 3 great-grandkids.
4 + 6 + 3 is 13 people that wouldn't have been born if you didn't make it home from World War II.
That's for sure, yes.
When you look back today and so often I hear on this program about veterans have this opinion, this feeling, that kids today don't know what it was like in World War II.
No, they don't.
They aren't being taught all of the history. So if you had one of your grandchildren who came up to you and said, Grandpa, what was World War II all about? Why were you guys over there fighting? What do you tell them?
I'd have to generalize.
You know, go ahead. Feel free to generalize for us right now.
Well, I'd just say, it was... fighting an oppressor, and I got called. I got drafted. I didn't volunteer, but I did my part. And there were must have been 10 million of Americans.
16 million.
16 million.
That's right.
Right. Who did their part, and many never came back. Many lost arm and limb, and it's a sad thing when you recall the outcome of war. But the result was that we established peace again.
Absolutely. And you lived, before you moved to the San Joaquin Valley, you lived in the Washington, D.C. area for a number of years, and most of your family is still back there. So I know that you have had the privilege, that a lot of World War II veterans haven't, of visiting the World War II Memorial.
Yes, I have.
What do you think about that? When you go there, does it make you feel like what you did was important? Do you feel like it captures the essence of what you and your fellow Americans did?
Well, I think it's a wonderful memorial. And but it's a very touching thing to think that on the mall, that they dedicate that land for a memorial to those of us who served. But I'm glad I served. It was important to put an end to the hostilities there with the Germans. It wasn't. I'm not against the Germans. I was against the regime. I liked the Germans. My first wife was German.
Mm-hmm.
And
obviously you had 1,000 German POWs that you took care of.
They were very nice. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And I was glad that it ended. I can't get over it. I can't tell you the joy I heard when they said the war was over. I can't describe it.
And they even said it in French.
Oh, yeah, la guerre finie.
Well, that is a perfect way to bring the program to a close today. Mr. Benson, thanks so much for sharing some of your experiences with us, and thank you for serving our country.
Thank you for having me, too.
That's Philip Benson of Madera, California. He's been our guest today. We'll be back next week. And by the way, if you want to see a picture of what he looks like now and what he looked like during World War II, go to our website, kmjnow.com, or check out Hometown Heroes on Facebook. That's the program for today. Thanks for listening on News Talk 580 KMJ.